Thanks for coming to our panel today. As you may have heard, the SSL certificate infrastructure has been under some stress lately. And so we've invited some, as they say, distinguished panelists to give you their opinions about it. So the way this is going to work is they're each going to talk for about 10 minutes, and then we're going to open up to questions. So what I will ask you to do is actually hold your questions, except for sort of clarifying questions for that, for the initial, like, you know, commentary, because otherwise we sort of get into a panel situation before people have all finished speaking. So from left to right, we have Stephen Kent from BBN, Adam Langley from Google/Chrome/ I don't know what else Google stuff, Brian Smith from Mozilla, and Stephen Schultz from Princeton. We'll be speaking, actually, I think, in that order, or in the opposite order. First we have Stephen Schultz. And I have biographical information here. He's the Associate Director of the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton. His work at CITP includes internet privacy, computer security, government transparency, and telecommunications policy, and he holds degrees from Calvin College and MIT. So please give a round of applause for Stephen.
Thanks, Eric. I think distinguished is a bit of an overstatement, particularly in my case. On a panel like this, I'm not particularly well qualified, but perhaps by speaking first, you'll forget whatever stupid comments I make by the end of the other presenters. As he mentioned, I come from the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton. There are several of us out in the audience and at the conference here. We study the intersection of technology and policy, of course, doing quite a bit of security research, but also looking at where that intersects with public policy and the law. So I'll speak briefly about some of my thoughts. I'm also a newcomer to SSL, TLS, PKIX security work, but an active participant in several of the forums, and particularly interested at this moment in time in where the technology is going. Our friends from EFF did most of the work for me on this first slide, so I'll move fairly quickly through it. This is a short and incomplete list of the fundamental problems with our current system for web security, I'll use PKIX colloquially, as our last panel did. Of course, if everything is implemented to spec, we have fewer problems. Unfortunately, they're not. So fundamentally, of course, we trust too many people. You saw that in that very large graph from the previous panel. We have incomplete knowability of who is trusted. This is the subordinate certificate authority problem, and the problem that currently the infrastructure allows a great deal of delegation of trust without necessarily informing the end users of where that's being delegated. In fact, we even have a poor definition of trust. As we also discussed a little bit in the last panel, when PKIX began, we had an understanding that certificate authorities were going to validate actual real-world identity of the people they were granting certificates to, but we have slowly had a slide toward domain validation, which doesn't validate anything about real-world identity. And then we have tried to graft back onto this system standards like extended validation that require a certain amount of real-world validation. But ultimately, this leads to a great deal of confusion among users as to what trust means, what they're being told by certificates, and of course, as we see in user surveys, users saying things like, users saying that their perception of reality is entirely disconnected from the actual technical details. They think that the lock icon means the site is trustworthy, it's insured, anything that they do on the site is quote-unquote safe, and this is very different from the technical understanding of what's going on. We have quite a bit of delegation without constraint. We discussed this in the context of name constraints. The system by default works now in such a way that anyone who gets any power to generate leaf certificates or an entity certificates has power to generate them for the whole world. This is troubling. our assumptions for the system assume that we have active and informed users that understand how this works and are actively managing who they trust, which is an unreasonable assumption that doesn't play out in practice. Feeding into this problem, we have inconsistent and increasingly inconsistent user interface. If, for example, you look at the most recent versions of Firefox and compare it to the most recent versions of Internet Explorer, the user indicators for the same set of scenarios, let's say extended validation or domain validation, are different and have been diverging in recent versions. So Mozilla has, for example, completely done away with the lock icon for any domain validated certificates and adopted a bluish indicator that is ever fading into less and less blue. I anticipate at some point it will just become gray, which is in fact arguably the best approach given what domain validation can actually ensure to the end user. But when we have diverging user interfaces, it's very complicated what we're communicating to end users. And if we ever had any hope that they could understand what was going on, this is really working against that. We have a highly ambiguous legal architecture when it comes to liability. And of course, cash rules everything around me. And if certificate authorities aren't liable, or clearly liable, they don't necessarily have the right economic incentives. Exa 509 keeps breaking in creative new ways. It's a somewhat complex standard, and we find new and interesting ways to break it, although I'm not the expert on the panel on that. And accountability is hard, which is perhaps one of the chief conclusions from the SSL Observatory. Something that's new in the past couple of years is that mobile makes this all of these problems worse. And in some ways, what we're seeing is a flashback to the origins of implementing PKI. And we're seeing some of the same problems playing themselves out. So for example, user interface is hard. We have quite a bit less screen space and indicators to work with. And if you look at the UI indicators, they're even worse on mobile compared to the desktop. In fact, many mobile browsers don't distinguish at all between domain validated or extended validation certs, or is it's not prominent, etc. We don't necessarily have the user experience research to know how to do it. And if we didn't feel like we were solving it well on the desktop, it's only getting worse when it comes to the mobile space. And we are, of course, doing more and more on our mobile devices, and they're becoming more and more important. Likewise, user interface around more complex tasks like managing your cert database, assuming that users do such a thing, becomes significantly more difficult, and it's difficult to make it usable. The mobile platforms also introduce new opportunities for vulnerabilities. As someone mentioned in the comments, iOS included essentially a repeat of the basic constraints vulnerability that Moxie first demonstrated in Internet Explorer in 2002, I think it was. And this was just a few weeks ago. How that made it through the testing process is hard to imagine without getting caught. But in any case, as we have new platforms coming forward, we have code being written and rewritten, and new opportunities for the vulnerabilities to present themselves again. And we have in some platforms, a long cycle until patches get deployed. This is particularly true in something like the Android model, where the core platform exists, but all of the carriers customize that code and platform and decide how and when to deploy that. So, for example, if we had a known vulnerability and a patch for a known vulnerability, the way that that ultimately makes it out to end users is that the carriers have to decide to accept the patch, work it into their potentially customized version of Android, deploy it, and then get all of their users to presumably OTA update that. That can take quite a while, and in fact, if everyone within that ecosystem isn't on top of it, it may leave out huge numbers of end users. That's a different model from the current desktop OS update model, where the OS vendors maintain more close control. So we have to figure that into any fixes we want to do in the mobile space. My understanding of the history, and I wasn't around for this, but what I've heard repeatedly is that the security community's response has been to do things like work to fix X509, improve the crypto, improve key lengths, deal with problems like the Debian bug, to work on UI fixes and do user experience improvements to try to find out what kind of certificate warnings actually cause users to pay attention, and also to think about how they might fix the trust model. But what I've been told repeatedly is that ultimately the security community has, for the most part, gotten frustrated and moved on to other things. Now, you can tell me if this is true or not. I'm not a native here, but what I hear, especially from folks doing sort of the day-to-day grind around doing things like deciding whether or not to approve new applications for root certificate authorities, is that people may get interested, they'll participate in the community for a while, they'll get frustrated with the way the system works, coders will be involved for a little while, but ultimately they've actually found it hard to sustain strong community around it and sustain support. That being said, I feel like the last couple years or so, there seems to be a real uptick in interest, both in better patches to the existing model and in interesting new models, new ways of structuring the trust model. So some of those, a non-inclusive list, include various patches to the current model, both technical and operational. I would categorize SSL Observatory and other sort of third-party notaries as patches to the current model in the sense that they allow us to double-check how the system is working, and they're sort of overlays on top. Tremendously valuable, and especially valuable because they help to patch an already deployed system rather than assuming some magical future system that doesn't exist. And there are also operational patches to this. If you look at things like the way the Mozilla approval process works, and the ongoing hard work that they're doing around updating their policy and disclosure requirements and things like that, there are some things which are not code-based at all, but increase things like transparency to end users and to deployers. Folks, today I'm sure we'll talk about the DNSSEC and DANE approaches. We talked about that a little bit on the last panel. I think I'm more of an enthusiast for this than some of the folks on the panel, so maybe I can represent that position. HSTS, which I know folks will talk about as well, and Adam can also talk about CAA, so I'm not going to spend too much time on that. So my final slide, these are a few things that as we talk about patches to the current model or possible future approaches, I think that these are variables that variables or characteristics that can be useful for sussing out whether or not they're likely to succeed or whether or not they're likely to fall prey to some of the existing problems. So looking at the sort of twin questions of delegability and constrainability, of course, where the current model falls down, we have completely unconstrained delegation of authority, and this generates problems. What might an alternative look like? What does the structure of that look like? Is it hierarchical? Is that authority excludable between different leaves, or do we have a different type of approach? Transparency. Can we do transparency in a way that's useful for people who want to watch the system while not assuming that end users will want to know every single detail, technical detail about who they're trusting and for how much? Of course, this relates to the usability question, and increasingly I'm convinced, as I think some others are, that the notion that users will be active participants in making trust decisions, even on the most basic level, is an unrealistic assumption, and what we really need to do is just make it work the best we possibly can without getting in users' ways. Easy to say, but difficult to do, but I think a respectable goal. And of course, deployability. There have been many ideas, many alternative ideas over time. The question is, can we actually get from point A to point B? I think there was a panel earlier in the week on how do you convince browser vendors to actually adopt your great security ideas. This is critical, and it's not just the browser vendors, it's the vendors, the people running the major websites, in some cases, people deploying the DNS infrastructure. And no matter how good your idea is in principle and in the abstract, I think deployability is a critical question for whether or not it's actually likely to succeed. In some ways, we today have an imperfect model that works, I guess, as I said in my title, it's the best option, it's the worst option except for all of the others, at least all of those that are deployed. And so we need to be realistic about what we're measuring it against and ask questions about deployability. So anyway, my reflections, but I'll turn it over, I guess, Adam's next. Thanks.
So next we have Adam Langley, and these are his words, not mine. He's a software engineer at Google who works on both the Chrome TLS stack and Google production HTTPS serving, and he continually abuses TLS in the name of performance and security. I would never have said abuses. I would have said improves.
Hello. Right, those of you who've seen me talk before know that my mouth usually drives my legs, but now I have to stand still because I have this podium. SSL. So thank you to my prior speaker. He let me know beforehand that he was going to ask me why it was that on an Android phone one could not remove CAs. And I'd like to take that as a starting off point. I suppose, as a rule of thumb, in order to evaluate any intervention, we multiply the security gain by the number of people who it realistically affects. So why can't I remove CAs, or why is this CA trusted is a common request I get, and some CAs come up more often than others. I'm not going to name names, but people can imagine what they are. And to answer that, I'd suggest that the number of people on the planet who would actually go into their Android phone and remove CAs is probably in the hundreds. And the security benefit they get from that, they can certainly remove many CAs, but they'll be removing the relatively inactive CAs if they want a functioning phone afterwards. And the relatively inactive CAs are also relatively unlikely to be issuing subordinate certificates. And so the number of organizations which they are vulnerable to, which they trust, probably does not go down all that much. So their security benefit is somewhat minimal, and the number of people is in the hundreds. Compare that, I suppose, to... I should point out, I asked the Android team if I could say anything about any future releases of Android, and the answer was to say absolutely nothing. So compare that to some of the interventions that I and others have been championing. I'm going to start off with HSTS. So for those who don't know, HSTS, in a 30-second summary, is a header that servers can send which says, always contact me over HTTPS. And the attack which this addresses is incredibly stupid, incredibly simple, and devastatingly effective. You simply grab the user's initial HTTP request, remove the upgrade to HTTPS, and then you own them. And this will work more than most of the time. Even in this audience, I suspect it will work, you know, some 10 to 20% of the time. And I mean, it's fantastic that Peter does the work he does investigating the vulnerabilities we have in certificates. But if we got to the point where certificate security was the weak link in our chain, that would be fantastic. And we're a long way away from that. And so we have HSTS, and it's in Firefox, and it's in Chrome. And if you run a large site, you should be sending these headers. And you should also email me so I can put you in the preloaded list, which I build into Chrome, so that, you know, users, there's no initial vulnerability before users have gone to a website and after they've cleared their cache and so on and so forth. And I see the occasional numbers about how many sites have deployed this, and it's been around for, I mean, 6 months now or so. And the numbers, so far I haven't seen a number over 100. Certainly we don't have that kind of number in the preloaded list. And in terms of large, significant sites, I mean, I hate to suggest that the rest of the HSDS sites are not significant, but in my mind, there are certain sites which are more prone to transport security attacks than others. And of the large significant sites, we have sort of Google and PayPal, and PayPal's been fantastic about this, but that's it. We don't have any banks. We don't have, we have a little bit of Twitter with some arm twisting, and I wish we had more Twitter. But even this extremely minimal intervention, you know, we are struggling and kicking and screaming, and at venues like this, I advocate it. And still we're seeing rather small amounts of uptake. But for the sites which do have it, the security benefit is actually fairly huge. It removes this incredibly simple and effective attack, and it does so without users having to do anything. And so the number of users that it affects is in the hundreds of millions, I guess, with Firefox and Chrome. How many users do you have, Brian? No idea. Right. Hundreds of millions, I think. And so as an intervention, like, I think that's far more interesting to me than a certificate dialogue to knock out root CAs. And, you know, there are other reasons why, you know, certificates, the problems with those are, you know, things we would love to be able to reach. Mixed scripting, for example. For those who attended Colin Jackson's excellent talk on Wednesday about how to get things into browsers, he mentioned that IE9, you know, took one for the team, those are his words, in that they blocked mixed scripting. And mixed scripting is where an HTTPS site basically delegates all its authority to an HTTP site. And obviously, not only is that terrible if you visit such a web page, but the attacker gets to choose the web page. They can send you there in an iframe in any HTTP request. You know, if you have mixed scripting on your site, you're dead. You have no transport security. And IE9 did take one for the team in blocking mixed scripting, and that's fantastic. And Chrome is moving towards that. The Chrome beta right now blocks mixed scripting by default with an info bar. Unfortunately, we're still asking the user, would you like to load this? But at least we block it by default now. But you know, we've been pushing this for a while. It's been in the dev channel, and we get a huge number of bug reports. And now it's in the beta channel, and this is going to use up our negative PR for the year. Like, my boss will not let me break anything else once I've done this for quite some time, because the amount of bug reports and screaming users we get is going to be astronomical. We got, just as a calibration, we got a lot of bad press about blocking 512-bit Diffie-Hellman key exchange. There were sites out there, it was a bug, we knew it was a bug with a common, well, not very common, but a load balancer, and it defaulted a 512-bit Diffie-Hellman key exchange, and obviously, you know, you can break that on a home PC in minutes. And in Chrome, we said, no, that's not okay, like, we're not going to trust anyone who has a 512-bit key exchange. And all the sites that broke all blamed us, and all the users all blamed us, and we got articles in major newspapers saying Chrome has done this ridiculous thing. And of course, you know, everybody here would go, well, I mean, of course you have to block it. We can't trust 512 bits. That's crazy. And so I guess my point is we have an awful lot to do. We have to fix mixed scripting. We have to get HSDS out there. We also keep in mind that most of the sites of the internet have no transport security at all. And, you know, that's for obvious reasons. The costs are that virtual hosting doesn't work. And that they source other things which aren't available over HTTPS, and you know they can't get, you know, these third-party suppliers to upgrade their serving, and so they're all trapped in this web of dependencies. And somewhere way down there is the idea that certificates are expensive and difficult to get. I don't think it's a significant cost for most businesses, but even if it were, Chrome will very soon support DNSSEC signed certificates. So, if you want to issue your own certificates and have DNSSEC on your zone, you can do that, and you can ask me how. And so, you know, we've got all these unsecured sites as well, and people are fighting this good fight. And once we get all that fixed, then we can start to worry about certificate security. And we have interventions in mind there. Chrome, as Peter pointed out, supports certificate pinning. So if you connect to Google, we won't trust every CA. Chrome will only trust a few CAs. And that's kind of complicated and difficult, and I haven't offered that up to everybody yet. I wonder if Brian, last time we spoke, said that he was thinking about ways to do this and maybe had an intern on it. Brian seems shocked. but maybe we'll have something there. But I've shopped this idea around to a few people I know who happen to run large sites who have been the victim of transport security attacks before on a huge scale. And so far, I haven't got any biters. Like, nobody's been interested in me pinning them in Chrome because they're worried about the operational aspects and so forth. And I'm sure we'll have a discussion later about ways in which we can do this. But I think they're probably perfectly reasonable. They know that there are all these other problems that they've got to get up to before they have to worry about certificates. And they know that a huge fraction of their users, their machines are owned by malware anyway. So what's the point of transport security if you can't trust the host? And so when we talk about certificates, and we should, because it takes so very, very long to do anything, Windows XP is 30%? I don't know. What fraction of machines in the world are still Windows XP, operating system from 10 years ago? 40%. Okay, so in 10 years, it's a little under half. So in another 10 years, it's maybe 20%. We don't really know if it decays like that because we haven't been running computers and an internet at this scale for long enough to have any real data. But we can well imagine that I would have to have and raise children in order to carry on my work before we get to change the certificate infrastructure in the web in a way that isn't going to break 5% of users, because like no website on the planet is going to say, well, I could spend $50 on a certificate, or I could get another 5% of users. So it's good we're thinking about this now because it takes so long to do, but we've got so much further to go. And I hope, is that about 10 minutes? Excellent, thank you very much.
Okay, next we have Brian Smith from Mozilla, who works on network security and network performance.
Okay, to start off, I just wanted to give some credit to the people that have been working on extensions to Firefox to prototype new ideas in this space, because I think that is really going to have a big influence on any improvements that we make in Firefox and other Mozilla products to solve the kind of problems that we'll be talking about today. And this is just a very small sample of the extensions that are available that we discuss regularly when we're trying to solve these problems. And our requirements for a solution or solutions or improvements to certificate misissuance or certificate trust problems basically boil down to these bullet points. First of all, anything that we add to what we do has to have a clearly positive security impact. If we can't say that it's definitely always a positive impact, it's going to be difficult. Like, so for example, if it's something that confuses users, then even 90% of the time, 99% of the websites you go to, it makes sense. But then your bank, somehow it says, oh, maybe you shouldn't be trusting your bank when there's really no problem. That is not an acceptable solution. Similarly, we're interested in the idea of using external hosts to give us information about websites and the trustworthiness of websites, but we're concerned about the reliability of those, and we see that even with OCSP, where in Firefox, if we don't get an OCSP response, we just assume it was good, which really kind of doesn't make sense. but breaking websites because of the unreliability of an OCSP responder is worse. Another thing that's really important to Mozilla is that we want to protect users' privacy. And so when we think about, like, we're going to ask a site, hey, is this website that the user is visiting trustworthy? We would rather not tell them what site the user is going to or provide any kind of additional tracking information for users. And another really important thing that's really overlooked quite often when we discuss these things is the need for performance to be good, because one of the main problems, I think probably the biggest problem here, is most sites are not using HTTPS all the time. And one of the things that always gets brought up is the performance impact, the load impact on the server. And we're trying to convince people that that performance impact or those concerns are not as applicable now, and we're trying to do more things in the product to make HTTPS more efficient, including some things that Google has already done. The freshness, the timeliness of information, it's great to have some indication that a site is trustworthy or untrustworthy, but it's less great if that information was based on something that was found out a year ago, for example. So, like, this is an issue, I think, with domain validated certificates that are 3 years old. Nobody has really done anything to verify that that the organization that's controlling that certificate or that is using that certificate is legitimately using it. And also, we have to make sure that we don't choose any kind of solutions that server administrators will find so difficult or will be easy for them to get wrong. This is one of the concerns that I have about DNSSEC, that maybe the tooling is not there, the usability is not there, and it's easy to, for them to screw it up and either take their servers down and DOS themselves, or leave configuration files that didn't have, like, sensitive information in them previously laying around or not properly secured, and involuntarily disclosing information just because they don't know what they're doing. And auditability, I think this is one of the problems that is pretty clear in our current certificate model. We don't even know all the CAs that can really issue certificates that we trust in our product, because we delegate the ability to sell CA rights to other CAs that are in our root program. So I could not even tell you, like, is this organization capable of issuing a certificate for Mozilla.com or Google.com or PayPal.com? And I think that that is something that we really need to change. Things that we're investigating now are Dane and Dane-like things, which either pin certificates to or let a server administrator choose which CA or choose a specific certificate that they want to use on their site. And basically, the idea being that the server administrator at least should have one good choice of CA. There should be one good CA that is they consider to be trustworthy, and we should respect that decision and make sure that we don't accept certificates from other CAs that nobody has decided is trustworthy. And another thing that we are considering is a little bit more radical than that, and that is the idea of using something like Perspectives or Moxie's talk on convergence. For example, last week, we have a lot of concerns about how the details of that would work, but that's not something that we're rejecting outright just yet. And we're really trying to figure out a way to make something like that work so that we are not really the arbitrator of trust through our root CA program. And the other thing we want to do is, I really love all these extensions that people have made for Firefox, and I want to find out what can I do to help people prototype their ideas more, faster, get them more widely deployed, work with us in a more close manner, and including even, you know, sitting next to me in my office. We have office space for people to come work with us on this stuff if you want it. So, yeah, so enough of that. So, because we're concerned about user privacy, we're trying to think about like what transport channels are going to be best for getting this information. And one of the attractive things about DNS is when you go to a web or when you visit a website, you tell your DNS server, hey, I'm going to this website. So it doesn't really hurt to share more information that, hey, I also want to know the key for this website, or I want to know the trustworthiness with that DNS server, because you're already telling it where you're going. Whereas if we're contacting like a third-party website, now we're telling the DNS provider and that third-party website. So we're telling more of the user's browser history to more sites, which is something we want to avoid. Unfortunately, if you try and extend DNS, even with DNSSEC, it doesn't always work. There's a lot of home networking equipment where it won't go through, or there's a lot of things that get filtered out for whatever reason. And also, if we rely on DNSSEC, then we need to have a DNSSEC, a fully validating DNSSEC resolver in our product, which we are a little bit hesitant to do. But actually, we've had offers of already working DNS resolvers to put in our product. We're just not sure that that's the best approach yet. Another approach is to tell the server that we're contacting, hey, give us all the information that we want about the trustworthiness, including information from DNS. Basically, proxying the DNS request for the DANE record or whatever through the TLS handshake. Again, this has the same kind of privacy-preserving properties that we're looking for, but it does require more work on the server administrator's behalf. They have to update software to software that hasn't been written yet. Although, like in Google's approach to doing it, they embed it into a certificate and kind of avoid that problem. I think that that doesn't really work for existing certificates that you want to add information about DANE or whatever to. But that's a very good approach for the self-signed case. And you have to deal with the fact that an attacker is not going to tell you information they don't want you to know. You know, so when you don't get that stapled information, you can't really make a determination if it's just because they haven't updated to whatever mechanism we come up with to staple that information, or if the attacker is purposely trying to avoid giving you that information. So I'm really interested in talking especially about technical aspects of ways to improve things on the policy side. I'm not sure how much information I'm going to be able to give you because I'm not the king of policy at Mozilla, but I'm very interested in, especially if people have technical ideas or want to work more closely together with Mozilla, please email me your ideas or what you have in mind, and I'll be glad to work with you. Thank you very much.
Our final panelist before we have questions is Dr. Stephen Kent. He serves as the principal investigator on numerous security R&D projects at BBN for almost 30 years. In the Internet Standards Arena, he served as, wow, that's a list, a member of the IAB from 1983 to 1994, chaired the Privacy and IRTF Security Research Group from 85 to 98, Privacy Enhanced Mail from 90 to 95, and is a co-chair of PKIX from 95 on. He's the principal author of the core IPsec standards and co-author of many of the emerging ITF CIDR standards for routing security. Since 1997, he's lectured on the topic of network security on behalf of this huge list of government agencies, universities, private companies all over the world. He received a BS in mathematics from Loyola and the SME and PhD degrees in computer science from MIT. He's a fellow of the ACM. Welcome, Steve Kent.
Really? Oh, John. So this presentation is going to be at the opposite end of the spectrum from the last two. Particularly, we're going to talk about issues in sort of philosophy of public key infrastructure and things that I think make sense. and then see how that fits into the topic for this panel session. And since I'm in California and this is a very green state, I'm recycling. In particular, this was based on a presentation from 1997, which I still think is appropriate even though nobody does it. So let's go back to the beginning. What is and a CA is, by the way, a certification authority, not a certificate authority. What's the fundamental requirement for a CA? What is it supposed to do? Well, only two things. It's supposed to establish and then maintain an accurate binding among a collection of attributes in a certificate. And this is easier if you know who the set of consumers, the relying parties are for the certificates that you issue, because the things that they really care about should be the attributes that you make sure are absolutely correct in the certificate you issue. What makes for a good CA? Because we've certainly heard in the previous session, and people have talked about today, the notion of bad CAs. What do we expect generally? Well, the usual requirement that we focus on is binding a public key to a collection of identity attributes. There are lots of other things that could be more important in other environments. For instance, the CIDR work that I've been involved with now in the ITF for several years, identities are irrelevant. What counts in the certificate is not so much the subject name as an extension, an RFC 3779 extension that says which chunks of IP address space you hold. So it's not always identity, but in our environment, identity is important. So in the TLS SSL environment, the public key and a name which can be mapped to the name of, for instance, the website you're trying to access, that's what we care about the most. One of the issues that people don't tend to talk about, and I haven't heard it this morning and I haven't heard it so far in our panel today, is, are the CAs that we're talking about authoritative for that binding, or is this a matter of trust? Because everybody talks about trust. And that's where things start to go south, frankly. And then the last bullet is just one, because I wanted eventually to have something named after me and all the good physical laws were taken, and I'm not a physicist. So back in the mid-90s, I came up with Steve's rule of revocation, which says the effective lifetime of a certificate is inversely proportional to the square of the number of attributes you cram into the certificate. Inverse square has that nice physical sciences kind of flavor to it. Under the heading of you can't make jokes, when I posted this to the PKIX mailing list 15 years ago, people started a serious argument about whether it was inverse square, inverse linear, inverse n log n. Lord knows I tried. So any good talk for an audience like this as we're heading into lunchtime should involve sound bites, so I have a few for you. We have had different PKI models over time. X509 started in the mid-80s, became a standard initially, version 1 in the latter part of the 80s, and they had a few basic precepts. The first one is distinguished names, directory distinguished names, are good for you because X509 is part of the X500 committee, which was doing the directory information tree. And they really thought that was appropriate. It's going to be really big. Everything will be registered in it. That's why it's important. Okay, didn't get that one right. PGP came along as a kind of alternative counterculture approach to this. I expropriated a line there from Treasure of the Sierra Madre, obviously. And PGP has more of a, shall we say, laissez-faire, to be polite, approach to all of this. And I think it's appropriately used in certain contexts, none of which I'm involved in. X509 V3, we skip V2, no one ever talks about it. It was a bad thing. They didn't invent extensions at that point, which was a good thing for the most part. They added two new optional fields, which fundamentally resulted because the people doing it didn't understand how to do access control in the directory. Thank God nobody uses them, those fields anymore. So V3 has the problem that extensions are not a bad idea. It's just that when you let people keep adding them on willy-nilly, they can get bad. They can have unintended side effects on occasion, but mostly they just make it much, much harder to implement a comprehensive relying party software or CA software. They did finally realize that the directory tree was not catching on, and so they allowed some alternative forms of identifiers that they thought might be useful, things like domain names, email addresses, etc. But the committee approach to this was telling because we kept getting more and more of them. Now, in the PKIX working group that I chair in the ITF, we sometimes take the Nancy Reagan approach to this and we just say no. The polite form of that is called deprecating. which I'm pretty sure in California you're allowed to do. And so we deprecate some of these, and in fact, the speakers in the previous panel session talked about all the different kinds of reason codes for revocation in a really cool slide in a nice multicolored graph. The PKIC standard says don't. Just say you revoked it, get over with it, you know, move on. Obviously, people don't always follow that. Now, for different models of CAs, of course, you can also have sound bites. One model that I'm especially fond of is the organizationally empowered one, where organizations issue certificates for their employees or the devices they're producing, their own websites for internal use, et cetera. Another one is the geopolitically empowered. Now, whether or not this turns out to be good depends on where you live. For certain countries in Europe, for example, especially smaller countries like Belgium, the government comes along and says, yep, we're issuing you smart cards. They have certificates on them. They don't even ask questions. It's, you know, we're just going to do this. The United States, you know, we're still on this, you know, right to keep and bear arms thing. And so issuing certificates to everybody by the government is not likely to be popular. What our government is currently trying to do is the can we get other people to pay for it approach, which is we'd like all the citizens to have certificates, but we, the government, don't think we can pay for it because we're running this little deficit thing. And so we'd like to get other organizations as third parties to issue certificates. They can collect the money from you. We'll accept the certificates from them. What could possibly go wrong there? The universally empowered approach, that works so well for Alexander Haig, for those of you who may remember President Reagan's failed assassination attempt on Reagan. The liability empowered approach, which is what we principally see in the browsers. Trust me, I'm authoritative for nothing, but I have big market share, and so you really should go ahead and put me in your browser. And the proprietary approach, which I'm also going to talk about more, going back to a 60s rock song title, if it's your namespace, you can just go ahead and certify things in that environment. And all of us carry around examples of that today. I mean, who am I? Well, the Department of State issues me one of these as a form of identification. I have cute little cards from Hilton that say I'm a Diamond member because I spend a lot of money with them. US Air that says I'm a Platinum member because I fly a lot of miles with them. Marriott that says I'm Platinum because I sleep there frequently. United, which says, ooh, yes, Global Services, I million-mile flyer, I fly with them a lot. Which one of those is the right credential for me? Answer is they're all the right credential for me in a context. So this notion of I could have a certificate that's good for everything is just utter nonsense. We don't do it in the physical world or in our plastic and paper world. Why should we possibly think it makes sense in cyberspace? It really does not. So there are no certification authorities, I assert, that are universally authorized or that will be universally trusted. We have different namespaces in which we operate as people versus machines, for example. And it's appropriate to talk about having certification authorities that are authoritative for certifying an identity in a particular namespace where they really are authoritative. And we have tons of examples of those. All of the things I just talked about do that for me. And they just put my name on it, and my name by itself is not globally unique. So how do they fix that in every single case? They give me an account number. And that account number is actually unique relative to their context, and my name is on here so I can figure out, you know, which card is right, or in the case of the credit cards, and you go to dinner and five people throw their Amex Platinum cards on the table, you want to make sure you get the right one back later, or maybe not. So authorized certification authorities, I argue, are what we really should be doing in all cases. Organizationally, for instance, having my employer issue certificates to its employees, to its members, if you're talking about a society for ACM, IEEE, et cetera. Governments issuing them to citizens, residents, maybe companies are a possibility. But trusted CAs, CAs that are authoritative for nothing and are just getting you to trust them, that's just fundamentally heading down a bad path from day one, and unfortunately, that's the way we are running certificates in the browsers. It's not a failure of PKI technology. It is not, I will disagree with our first speaker, a X509 vulnerability. I haven't seen a X509 vulnerability show up in a long time. I constantly see, and I learned about a new one this morning, of implementation errors having to do with processing certificates. Not my job. I only make the standards. I don't write all the code. In fact, nobody lets me write any code. So I proposed back in 1997 the Mao Zedong certification model. And it's easy because everybody will remember Mao, I think, for a long time. Other Chinese leaders come and go. But he had catchy phrases of his own, sound bites, one of which was the let 10,000 flowers bloom, and let's just translate to the CA space. Imagine taking all the organizations that exist, which are authoritative for some namespace, and just sprinkling pixie dust on them and saying, you're a CA. Because frankly, it's not that hard. In fact, we've demonstrated that a lot of companies that collect money for it do it so badly, obviously. Well, I guess it could be hard, but it's not. They're greedy, and they're provided the wrong financial incentives, as you pointed out, to do the right thing. Organizations that are authoritative for namespaces have the right incentive to do the right thing. And so that makes life better to begin with. The subject name for the certificate is taken from an existing database, typically, because if you had a database to identify all these things and it's authoritative, just do that. Servers, a client software, TLS software, has been capable for years, if we're talking about doing this for client certificates, and I'm focusing mostly because of this panel session on the server side of things, to even ask for the right certificate if I have a bunch of different certificates. Yeah, there's some privacy problems with that. Frankly, I think it's way down on the list compared to everything else I'm concerned about. So the advantages of the Mao model are that authoritative CAs, you know what they're responsible for, they're limited. Basically, it's an extreme approach to the name constraints use that we've talked about earlier. Certificate validation, typically in many of these instances, if you look at it in detail, becomes trivial. In many cases, revocation is really easy. That's not in every case, but in many cases it is, because if I'm handing certificates out to a set of people who are then going to present them back to me for validation, I don't even have to publish a CRL. I don't have to run an OCSP responder. I ask me whether they've been revoked or not. So it doesn't work in every case, but in many cases it would work very, very easily. The liability issues that drive or should drive public trusted third-party CAs to charge more as opposed to mere greed go away as considerations, because you're not assuming any new liability. You're just doing what you were doing before, and by the way, you're also issuing a certificate. That means that the cost to establish and operate these CAs can be considerably lower relative to trusted third-party CAs. And what the right level assurance is, well, it will vary based on the context. And because each context has its own CA, you can do it appropriately. And the policy scope is very clear for this. We do have an example that's being deployed now on a worldwide basis that follows precisely this model, and it is for the SIDR working group. And what we are doing is having all the entities who allocate address space become certification authorities. IANA, the five regional registries, and then beyond that, certification authorities. Because of the extension that's used to identify the address space and the validation rules that go with this, it implies the equivalent of name constraints in the address space, because this is a hierarchic allocation system, so it's easy to do and it makes perfectly good sense. And I've spent the last 5 years going around the world convincing the folks at the regional registries to do this and saying, you're not going to attest to who you've handed the address space to whom rather. You're just going to say whoever has the private key corresponding to the public key in the certificate, they own this chunk of address space for now. So we're trying to make this work, and so far there are a few thousand certificates out there. Hopefully this will grow over time. So getting back to the subject of the panel, how does TLS relate to this? Well, the relevant identity in the certificates that we're talking about today is the DNS name encoded in the certificate in one of several approaches, one of which is preferred and other of which are used historically. The DNS is the authoritative source for DNS names. Whether it's always right or not, it's authoritative. Just get over it. A collection of people out there telling me whether or not to trust it, frankly, does not encourage me very much at all. We already rely, as Brian was pointing out, on the DNS to get to where we're going. Nobody's going around typing in IP addresses. And so tying this to the DNS, as long as we can transport the data and make it work properly, seems like a natural thing to do. These are the authoritative folks. And so the DNSSEC combination of using DNSSEC to bind the attributes to the DNS name, public keys, or certificates is a starting point for this. The Dane Working Group that I suspect we'll chat about during our Q&A with folks momentarily is pursuing this, developing standards. I think this is a great alternative to the current trusted third-party approach. And there are ways to do this in a fashion which don't make it either or, which allow both of them to coexist simultaneously. And you could gradually work your way through away from the trusted third-party approach. And so I wouldn't have to go into my browser on this machine, for instance, and disable a handful of trust anchors that I say, oh, give me a break. I do not want them in here at all. It's much, much better than the self-signed certificate approach also. The way it works today. And I have a tendency to like to finish up my presentations with photos that I've taken. So that's my last slide. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. So I'd encourage people who have questions to line up at the microphone to get things started. I actually have a question, sort of. Imagine some ideal world where all the technical infrastructure was solved, and you simply had an absolute guarantee, as Stephen suggested, that binds a DNS name to a public key. How far would that actually get you, given how little knowledge the users have of what the expected DNS names are and what they mean?
That sounds like a policy question. Should we start?
I think it's a usability question. So it certainly doesn't get you real-world identity unless you as a user know conclusively what real-world identity sits behind a known domain name. And even in that scenario, you have typo squatting and similar name issues and crazy stuff that happens when you... when you get all sorts of new character sets. That being said, what you do get is encryption in all the scenarios where one of those nefarious things isn't happening, and you get it in a relatively automated fashion. And given the challenges around getting sites to simply go through the operational difficulties of deploying certs today, if that helps move the ball forward and solves a significant percentage of situations where someone is at risk of being man in the middle, we saw in the last, it really blew up in the last 3 or 4 weeks, PAX fire search hijacking. Essentially your ISP man-in-the-middling you for all of your search queries and delivering you targeted ads. If all of the sites out there were easily and transparently already using HTTPS by default and that were enabled through the DNS, it makes those sorts of things much more difficult to do. But as it stands, we have this two-part model where I think Peter was talking about this on the last panel, where you get your DNS from one place and you get your certificate from another place, and often there's an operational disconnect between those two. So that's my response. Do folks have more thoughts?
So Eric, I think that's a really good question. I guess from my perspective, I'd be more comfortable if I just got that basic approach, because the places that I go to on a regular recurring basis that I really care about are all bookmarked. If that's not the case, then I have to first rely on my buddy from Google to have given me the correct search results to something I typed in where I misspelled it and it already corrected my misspelling for me, and I picked from one of several pages, and so yeah, I could wind up at the wrong place that way. But for recurring use, I think just getting that right would be good. As you point out, it's not a housekeeping seal of approval. It's you went to the place you said you wanted to go to. Whether you wanted to go to that place is a separate issue. And I think it's fine to have a third party handing out certificates of trustworthiness in that fashion. But that's separate from the fundamental mechanical thing that we set out to do with SSL and TLS, and which has degraded over time for all the reasons that people pointed out.
And that third party's activities can be complementary to that existing
structure. It's not either
structure.
One.
Yeah.
I don't think I have anything particularly insightful to add to that.
Me neither, but I'll say something anyway. I wonder how much users really care about like the real identity of a site, or if the idea of a site is just like something they type in to get to what they want to do. Like, for example, do people really think about Facebook Corporation or whatever when they type Facebook.com, or are they just trying to get to the same place that they've always gone to chat with their friends? So in that sense, I'm not sure that the real identity of the host of the site is really that important.
So just one comment about this previous discussion. I think we should separate two links, is the user to the browser and the browser to the remote server. I feel this discussion is mostly about from the browser to the remote server and how the user actually goes to a website. I feel that's an orthogonal problem. But in any case, I do have two questions.
As a user interface question, or?
Yeah, for example, one solution, like Steve mentioned, is you can use search engine. But that also, of course, has some potential issues. Like we heard from the talk in the past couple of days, you know, search engine optimization problems being poisoned. But in any case, my question is, one question is for Steve. In the DAIM model, where you use the DNS hierarchy as the certificate infrastructure, in that model, what do you do? Could you comment on, you know, the part of that infrastructure that reside in other countries, and if they are, you know, misgiving the certificates in those regions, and how do we do about that?
Well, in the DNS, of course, below the root are a couple of hundred or so country code top level domains, and then the historical top level domains, and then the new ones that ICANN is creating. If you're going to a place that has a DNS name that's issued under a country code top level domain wherever, then by definition, whoever is operating that country code top level domain would be, from a DNSSEC standpoint, in that chain going down, and that's therefore explicitly going to be in the validation path implied when you get the results back from DAIM. And if we're going to use a DNS for this, there's no getting around that. It's all a question of where it happens to be located. But at least it's a very, using the term that's come up earlier, transparent mapping. You know who each of those points are, or you can know, because it was there in the browser bar when you said, yes, I want to go there.
Okay.
And I think that really is a feature of DAIM and sticking stuff in DNS. I think if we assume that users have any awareness of what's going on, perhaps it can be with respect to the domain name. And I'm sure there's a security usability person just waiting to jump up and say, no, users have no idea what domain
name. Yeah, I agree with that. I feel the user doesn't care.
But it's hard for me to imagine anything more minimal that users could pay attention to beyond the scary boxes that have not worked in the past. So I like that. If it's going to work, maybe that.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I will point out yet another extension that was added at PKIC's insistence, not from X509, which I haven't seen deployed very much so far. And it's a good news, bad news thing. The good news is that it's the kind of thing that could definitely give users a warm, cozy feeling in a straightforward fashion. The bad news, it's not subject to the kind of constraints we can impose otherwise. And it's the inclusion of a GIF or similar graphic in a certificate associated with a site, because people, from a usability standpoint, associate logos with the places they're going. The bad news is, if you have an unconstrained set of CAs issuing this, well, that's not going to make things necessarily more secure. And if we do something like DAIM, now you have an opportunity to present the misleading logo because somebody mistyped it and went to the wrong place. So, as I said, good news, bad news.
Nick Weaver, general.
And I think Brian, would you assist me?
Yeah, I have also thought about this logo issue too, and I think that one of the problems is even two legitimate sites could have very similar logos, but hopefully not in this, not also similar domain names. I still think you would have to look at the name that you're going to, or have some kind of mechanism like safe browsing, for example, is kind of like a backup mechanism for typo squatting, at least for nefarious typo squatting that is actually trying to do something bad to you.
Nick Weaver, general idiot.
Mike.
One slightly off-topic question is, we have all this certificate infrastructure that is sort of good and not, and hopefully better with Dane. The problem is there are good reasons not to run SSL, like there's a reason encrypted.google.com is a different domain for encrypted search. Because people who run the network, like I do work for at times, want to actually see all the traffic. What are the odds for the browser vendor on the stage of getting data integrity in HTTP based on all the certificates, so that at least we don't have to worry about the man in the middle belonging to the ISP modifying my Google results?
Okay, so the idea has come up previously. So there do exist man-in-the-middle proxies for SSL, and as a browser vendor, I mean, everybody here wishes they didn't exist, but they do. And I've chatted with a couple of vendors of those proxies and said, you know, how little would you accept? Now, at the moment, you have us by the balls, but maybe we could come to a compromise here where, you know, we give you the encryption key but not the MAC key or something, or, you know, something that would allow them to observe without modifying. And unfortunately, their answer is no, we need total control over everything. I think the idea you were alluding to was that we could have integrity over HTTP.
Yes, in the headers.
Right. So that usually comes up because people want HTTP's caching with HTTPS's, guarantees. And it's not unthinkable that one could imagine a script tag which says, you know, source equals this, hash equals this, and insecure source equals this. So if the browser knows what it's doing, it can go to the insecure source over HTTP, benefit from the caching of HTTP in the network, and still validate the hash which was given to it over a secure channel and so forth. That's totally doable and deployable. I fear that nobody would ever really use it. If there were enough people shouting and screaming at me that we need this, or God forbid, Apaches, that's something that could happen. As you mentioned, it may break because people are behind proxies which try to modify this, and then we pick that up as breakage. Difficult to know. We would have to do fairly extensive and expensive testing to see how broken it would be before deploying it.
Hi, I'm Diana Smetters, and I am a security usability person. So. So one of the challenges I found in this idea, I find this, you know, this idea basically sounds like everyone is saying what we really want is local namespaces, right? I go to Google, Google tells me who else is Google, rather than say VeriSign or somebody else over there telling me who ought to be Google. And there's a lot of appeal from that to that from a security point of view. It makes it a lot easier for users to reason about. You know, my problem might not be, you know, as a user, I care that the Facebook I go to today is the same Facebook I went to yesterday. But in practice, one of the problems that makes that challenging is that there are relationships between businesses which span DNS names, right? MasterCard delegates to account online, things like that. So, but once you have an infrastructure that, you know, talks about SSL at the level of DNS and you organize trust at the level of DNS, you build something that you can, you know, you can build higher level constructs out of this that users might be able to understand. So the hard part about doing this, as I see it, is the fact that many of the problems with TLS certificates as they're deployed today land between the CA and the user. So 60%+ of the certificates on the internet are wrong, because they're not because the CA did anything malicious or there's a malicious proxy, but because, you know, your certificate's expired, or you configured it wrong, or you did something else. So users can't believe any information their browser gives them about the trustworthiness of certificates because they're all misconfigured. And the hard part about this local namespace model is that it puts more of the burden of configuration on the same people who are having so much trouble with our somewhat simpler model today. So do you guys have any ideas of how we build tools, how we, you know, how we actually would deploy this in a way that it would be right often enough that users could care.
I guess we're the deployment people, but I'm not sure what it is what's the idea that we're deploying. You said local namespaces.
So for instance, if I'm going to go use Dane to look up who I should trust, what CAs I should trust for, you know, rochester.edu, mm-hmm. Then I better have, you know, rochester.edu better have a Dane record that tells me what their certs are. The certs in rochester.edu better match that Dane record. They better be valid, you know, or self-signed or whatever. And all those things should line up nicely. Otherwise, I'm going to get all sorts of weird errors I'm going to ignore.
So you're absolutely correct that TLS deployment at the moment is kind of a disaster, and certificates being the bit which server admins get their hands on are just the worst of it. I feel an awful lot of this would be tooling, and if I had an infinite amount of free time, I would configure Apache to tell you, hey, by the way, you've got 10 certificates here, and 7 of them are useless, and you've included your root certificate, no very good point. Or you've only included 1 certificate, and it doesn't change to any root I know about. You should really have an intermediate here. I think we can get an awful long way with tooling. With DNSSEC, I have concerns about Dane, which I still expect someone to come and talk about. But at least with Dane, one can imagine that the server can download its own certificate. You just start it, and you have to give it the private key, and that has to be right, but that's only one file. And then we can say, by the way, you are, you know, foo.com. And the server can go and look up foo.com and say, no, I'm not, I've got the wrong private key. Or, okay, yeah, sure. And I can, you know, I have the public key and I can just build a certificate from that. So I hope that these problems are solvable in code, because code is something I can do.
I also think that opinions around user desensitization to these types of errors comes from the phase we went through of trying to throw up more and more certificate error messages at users in order to try to get them to pay enough attention to do something on their own. And it seems increasingly clear that as much as we need to make security just work without requiring their participation, when it doesn't work, I think we should also make it just fail. Having some sort of intermediate thing where the user has to decide, oh, this is not actually chaining up to my root, but do I really trust it? Am I supposed to look at the contents of the certificate? It doesn't make any sense. If you as a sysadmin if your users can't get to your site, you have some motivation to get it right. I mean, you can still do stupid things like put your private key on some publicly accessible directory. But Mao also said that power grows out of the barrel of a gun. That's a big gun. Likewise, the browsers have big guns in this space. And we've been trying to kind of play the middle road, I think, historically. And at some point, hard fails have to happen in different places.
Can I say absolutely?
Yeah.
So if you're on HSTS site, then certificate errors are hard. We do not ask the user to try and evaluate this thing. They do not understand and come up with a sensible decision, because we know they do not. And so if you type mail.google.com into Chrome and the certificate is bad, it's hard fail. And so we better get our certificates correct. If I could switch off that damn red warning in Chrome for everything, I totally would, but we can't without breaking the world. And HSTS is the best incremental solution that I have.
Brian, under what conditions are you willing to turn off the red bar and have a hard fail?
So one thing that I think is interesting is that we did make it somewhat tedious to like skip past the error message in Firefox, and I've noticed some bug reports for some sites where I go to the site and then I see that they have very detailed instructions about how to add their certificate to the trusted certificate store in Firefox to avoid this tedious procedure, like university websites, for example. And so I think if we made it a hard failed, I'm not sure that that type of problem would go away. I mean, I think that because they would give their students instructions how to avoid the hard failure, just like they are already doing for the soft failure.
But often the reason that that's happening today is because they want self-signed certificates and they don't want to pay or trust some external third party. If we have an alternative model where self-signed certificates work and don't hard fail, say, Dane, DNSSEC-based approach, then they are not going to be as persistent in trying to run these broken servers, and our users don't get used to the notion that properly working sites give them errors. Now, I know there are a lot of objections to Dane and DNSSEC, but presuming a model that works, we at least don't incentivize site operators to do that. I know that the CS department at Princeton has a self-signed certificate just because they're stubborn about this and probably an instruction page somewhere. But if they could sign it in DNS, I'm sure they would just do it that way.
So I feel the issue is not that they don't want to have to trust anyone else. The issue is that a wildcard and a certificate only matches one level of names, which isn't very useful for them, and they don't want to have to be an intermediate CA because, you know, despite the fact there may be a number of intermediate CAs, there's a lot of requirements and it's expensive and difficult to become one. DNSSEC, you know, for all of its troubles, does have some very inviting aspects, one of which is the hierarchical delegation. And if Princeton's CS department wanted to DNSSEC sign a certificate, they should come and ask me.
So I wanted to mention a talk by Moxie Marlinspike last week when he proposed a solution to the certificate authority problem. And he gave this talk at Black Hat and DEF CON. And his idea was this add-on to Firefox that bypassed the entire system. And it worked under the idea of this trust agility model, where that you weren't stuck trusting the same third party for a long time. And so that the users could at will, or at the behest of the browsers, change who they trusted based on mistakes people made. And so he flipped the model on its head. Instead of having the websites tell you to trust a third party, the users could choose a variety of sources to trust, a distributed model. And if they all agree that the certificate's okay, on a consensus, it's fine. And so he released a software that the browsers could one day implement really easy, bypassing the certificate authorities. And his other complaint was that DNSSEC, although it's distributed, the trust is still centralized based on the current ownership of DNS servers in the US. And so I thought this was an interesting solution, and I wanted to see if any of you guys had heard about this or are familiar with this.
So certainly I've heard about it. This is the convergence stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the reasons why I'm not coding that right now. So firstly, I think it assumes too much for the users. I want to give my users something which just works or just doesn't work, but nonetheless doesn't require them to think, because they are car mechanics and they are doctors and they are not computer scientists and they shouldn't have to be. I fear that this gives them too much to think about. And also with my crazy speed freak hat on, the idea that, you know, the browser makes a connection and then has to run off and, you know, do six DNS lookups and six HTTP requests to a bunch of random servers and spend hundreds of milliseconds doing this just drives the performance into the ground. So at the very least, the server would need a way to relieve me of the need to do this, which requires the server mostly to know who these trusted people are. So it's not a million miles away from possibility, but it's not there in its current incantation.
And if I can mention one more thing, I think he addressed the performance issue in that the certificates are cached. So once you're only the first connections to the sites that you need to trust are made, you don't have to update the certificate unless there's a change to it.
Which means that the notion of freshness, as you mentioned earlier, in terms of, oh, this CA didn't do anything bad and now it's done something bad, you can't have it both ways, frankly. So I don't think that's wonderful. I also think the reference to, IANA as the root for DNSSEC as U.S. controlled is a red herring.
I mean, there are some reasonable concerns about DNSSEC that some of these registrars are not the trustworthy bastions of security we might wish them to be. There have been some history there. But yeah, I agree. I'm not too worried about IANA.
Thank you. My second slide, I basically listed all those bullet points in anticipation of this question. I think that something like that can work. Like Adam said, I think it would work a little bit better if there was a different distribution mechanism for the information that the notaries would provide, such as through DNS or through a being stapled in the TLS handshake. One of the other issues we have as a browser maker is, like Adam said again, we can't expect users to like go through a list of potential notaries and choose which ones they think are good or not. We have to choose that, and then we're very close to where we are now with choosing which CAs we trust. The main difference is, I mean, you can imagine a system we have now where we take all our CAs and we say, hey, we want websites to start getting certificates from like 3 or 4 or 5 CAs, and they all have to match the same key. That would be very similar to what he is proposing with convergence.
Okay. And this reminds me of another idea I have had, which there are probably a lot of reasons why it wouldn't work, which I've mentioned to you before, and I'm giving it away as a free idea for whoever wants to implement this extension. But I don't see why, as a patch to the current model, someone couldn't build a better auto subscription system for different lists of trusted root CAs and maybe subordinate CAs as well, including blocking, active blocking of subordinate CAs. If you think along the ad blocking model, we have very dedicated people who spend their time culling lists of locations and different characteristics of ads in order to block them. They have different standards. Why can't I subscribe to the EFF list of more trustworthy CAs and less trustworthy sub-CAs and have that automatically distributed to my browser? I, of course, still need a key in order to guarantee that I'm getting the right stuff from them. Maybe if we can get more of that control in the hands of users, this is something where not every user can be expected to actively maintain their list, but every user can still have an actively maintained list that they agree with more or less.
Steven, can I just say why EFF won't ever publish that list?
I'm sorry, what?
There's a reason why EFF, at least in the specific case, won't ever try to publish that list. And that is that if you look at the most vulnerable CAs, they're often the ones that are the most important in terms of they're doing the most work going out and domain validating, as imperfect as that is, a whole lot of domains. So when Komodo issues bad certificates, there are a wave of people saying, we should remove Komodo from the trust root. But if you did that, 100,000 TLS websites would fall off the web tomorrow. And so editing the list of trust routes isn't going to help. Do we put Komodo in or take it out? Like, neither of those cases looks great.
So we have 3 minutes left, and we can run a little over, but we can't run ridiculously over because we're cutting into lunch. So can I ask people to keep their questions short? Yeah. And I'm cutting the line now, and I'll understand if people really have to leave, too.
Ask a very quick question. So this is kind of follow-up Nick Weaver's question. I'm Helen Wong from Microsoft Research. So I wonder whether what you think about HTTPS is really the complete solution for end-to-end security, exactly as Nick said. You know, the caching infrastructure, the CDN infrastructure can no longer be leveraged without being man in the middle.
So no, and I have designs privately for sort of how to replace that thing and deal with all the niggles that it doesn't currently deal with. But in my long list of things to do, a huge moonshot like that is not currently coming to the top. I wish at some point to be so free of responsibility to be able to try it.
So it doesn't matter how small you make the namespace, except for in very constrained things like banking. The user is going to know something you don't, and that is what context they are in and what risk they think they are taking. So if you try to just break it so they don't take risk, when the risk they think they're taking is watching an embarrassing YouTube video, they'll go and find something that fixes it. The browser and browser designers know a tremendous amount about risk users are taking, and and you just don't tell them. You know, if you're getting ready to enter your Bank of America password, which your keychain has helpfully remembered, to a site that's been signed by, you know, the Romanian government, your browser knows that, doesn't tell you. And what it will tell you, helpfully, is two hash values. Oh, gosh, did you, you know, I mean, I still can't figure out how that got in our browser warnings. Did you, yeah, did we, everybody come together and get really drunk and come up with stupidest user information ever? So yes. I think we need, well, all I can say is I don't remember that meeting, so maybe we were really drunk. But the user knows the context, and if we focused more on this is a risk communication problem, in addition to this is a technical problem, and allowed them to make decisions like hopefully we mostly don't speed when it rains because we see the context, I think that that is a critical and necessary part of the solution. Thanks for letting me rant for a second.
So I think the answer is, in the UX studies that I've seen, no matter how big a warning we threw up, even on banking sites, users ignored it. And maybe that's our fault because we throw up so many warnings. But the way to start addressing that is to remove the superfluous warnings, which we're trying to do, but it's very difficult because the internet moves incredibly slowly and is huge and is hard to steer. I agree at some point, maybe if we remove the superfluous warnings, users would pay more attention to our big scary warnings on banking sites, but currently we've just bored them to death.
All that your warnings are non-narrative, they don't use risk communication. I mean, there's 40 years of risk communication and they pretty much systematically violate all of them.
Michael Vrabel, UCSD and soon to be Google. I like the ideas behind DNSSEC and Dane, although I'm wondering about your thoughts on deployment. So I know, for instance, at UCSD, getting DNS changes made is very painful. So trying to set up a server and get a certificate into Dane, I imagine, would be difficult. For all of the faults, one of the benefits of having these separate CAs is that I can bypass the DNS infrastructure for getting a certificate. And thoughts on how to improve that or...
Well, I think that we can at least improve it. We can improve it significantly with just better tooling, I think. Whether that improvement will be good enough. Well, so you're saying like you have an administrator that makes it difficult for you to get your DS record signed.
Yeah, well, so UCSD specifically, there is one administrator for the entire campus, and it's a very flat namespace. So that's probably something for them to fix, but I'm wondering if there might be similar issues elsewhere.
Yeah, well, I guess I tend to think about these issues more in like a, I don't know how to solve that issue. I think we've been thinking about it more from like the top level domain, like Facebook.com, Google.com, like what can we do to help them? And then their kind of internal struggles between departments and stuff like that is their own fault. Maybe they should have a more Mozilla-like organizational structure.
So Warren Kamari, Google, and co-chair of Dane. I was just responding to the, you know, registrars and registries are not bastions of truthfulness and trust. Unless you're one of a very small number of folk, like Google, Microsoft, Facebook, and, you know, a small number of other names, you're already trusting your registrar and registry. You know, if they can take example.com and point it to name servers they control, they can go off and get a DV cert really easily and really quickly.
So yeah, it's absolutely true. The current DV cert sits on top of DNS already, so there's no additional vulnerability by going there. I guess I was comparing it to sort of my mental model of the ideal CA, which cannot sign in private, and, you know, and has to, their auditors cross-sign their certs, and DNSSEC can sign in private. But the chance of my ideal CA model ever existing is so absurdly minimal, it's probably wrong of me to criticize other alternatives for not living up to it.
We thank all the panelists.